Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We are dedicated to furthering understanding of the Great War and have around 6,000 members worldwide. For more information, visit our website at westernfrontassociation.com. It is the 16th of December. This will be the last episode of this year, and we will return in mid-January to resume our normal schedule. Well, on today's podcast, I have the privilege of speaking to Dr. Ian Isherwood, a historian, scholar, and author of a newly released book called The Battalion, Citizen Soldiers at War on the Western Front. Ian brings us a deeply researched and poignant account of the experiences of the 8th Battalion, the Queen's, the Royal West Surrey Regiment, during the First World War. This book is based on personal letters, memoirs, and diaries of men in the battalion, and offers a new perspectives on the emotional resilience and motivation of soldiers who fought in the conflict. Ian joined me from his office in Lancashire while he was over in the UK doing some research. Ian, welcome to the Dispatches podcast. I wonder whether, before we get onto the formal questions, whether you could tell us a bit about yourself and what you're doing in Lancaster.
Yeah, so this is a great question. So I'm in Lancaster, England. I'm from Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. I'm a native Pennsylvanian. I grew up outside of Pittsburgh, and then went on to graduate school, and got my PhD in history. I'm now in the United Kingdom leading a study abroad program. So I teach at Gettysburg College. I'm a tenured member of faculty there, and I've brought over 17 American and international students over to Lancaster University, where they're studying abroad this semester, and I'm teaching and supporting them in that program.
And we're here to talk about your new book, or reasonably new book, The Battalion, which looks, interestingly, at a British infantry division. Infantry battalion, not an infantry division. So let's start. Could you tell us what inspired you to write The Battalion and how this project came to life?
So the book came out of a digital history project that we did at Gettysburg College, and we're still doing at Gettysburg College. About 10 years ago, we received a letter collection at the college of one of the commanding officers of the 8th Queen's Royal West Surrey Regiment. And when we received those letters, myself and a few other colleagues decided to form a team to digitize those letters and release them to the public during the centenary of the First World War. But as we developed our project, I did some more research on the battalion, and I thought maybe of creating an edited collection of letters or assorted ephemera. But then I thought that there was maybe a bigger story in the story of this unit. So I got a little ambitious with the project, probably a little too ambitious. And I thought, you know, is it possible to tell the story of fighting the First World War on the Western Front from the perspective of one unit of citizen soldiers? And that was the central question that kind of guided me at first. And then I started writing the book around the concept of a micro history that then tells a bigger story about what it was like to fight the First World War and what it was like to not only adapt militarily over the course of 3 years of combat, but also to adapt for some of the officers and men emotionally to their experiences of war.
Now, the book is based on the letters of Lieutenant Colonel Hugh John Chevalier, great name, Jack Pierce. Could you tell us how these letters ended up being preserved in the United States and how they sparked the initial interest in studying a British battalion?
So this is a question that I get asked a bit and have been asked a bit as I've been working on this project. By all logic, the letters should not have ended up coming across my desk in central Pennsylvania. But in 2010, when I was writing up my PhD and working as an adjunct teacher at Gettysburg and Dickinson Colleges, I had a first-year student come up to me named Marco Dracopoli. And Marco came up to me and said, "I have my great-grandfather's World War I letters. Would you like to see them?" And Tom, as you know, people, when they know you're interested in a subject, they'll sometimes bring you things to look at. And I said, "Sure." And I expected 5 or 6 letters written by an American in the AEF or something. And what he brought me over a few months later was a box full of his great grandfather's letters, which consisted of about 300 letters, trench maps, assorted ephemera, newspaper clips, telegrams, medals, all kinds of things that were associated with this man's service. And as I started kind of diving into them, I realized that, he's not only this is an extensive collection, but that this fellow commanded a battalion for 1 year on the Western Front, but he was an officer in this unit for 4 years. And over the course of being an officer, we have basically his entire war experience that's told through this stuff. And he was a highly decorated officer too, as you know, Tom. So it's one of these things that it basically became a bit of a project for Marco and I to work on. So in his 4 years at Gettysburg College, he was really interested in World War I because of his family's experience. And so he wrote a paper on his great grandfather. And then in 2014, when he graduated, his family offered to loan the letters to Gettysburg College and to me to work on, and then eventually to donate them to the college. And we decided to put together a DH project on the letters because we realized that they're a real treasure trove. And then eventually I ended up writing a book that's largely based on Pierce's war experiences.
And we should say for eager listeners who want to go and look at these letters, they are available online, and you don't need to go to Gettysburg in the United States, but there are many other reasons to go to Gettysburg in the United States. But we maybe could touch on those later. Now, it's really intriguing that you, as an American academic, became deeply involved in the history of a British battalion. Could you explain why this particular story resonated with you and why it might be of interest to American readers?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little weird, isn't it? And I mentioned that in the introduction to the book too, that there's a group of Americans who are doing this work, but we have no connection, direct connection by blood or nationality to this particular unit. So one of the things that so I did my PhD in the United Kingdom, so I did it in Glasgow, and I did my PhD on the British publishing industry and war memoirs written by British servicemen in the First World War. So I was deeply kind of steeped in the literature of the war and in particular within the literature of the experiences of the war. And so I had a little bit of an academic background into the experience of the First World War, et cetera, et cetera. But what really resonated with me was the intimacy of Pierce's letters and the closeness that he felt toward his family. And honestly, some of the honesty of the letters too. I mean, Pierce writes home about staff officers. He writes home about his soldiers. He writes home about creature comforts. He's kind of a finicky officer in that way, in which he expects to get his hampers from Fortnum and Mason's and his overcoat from Burberry and all of that. So he's just a fascinating character. And as I started reading more about the battalion, kind of building this picture of what this unit was like around Pierce, it was clear to me that there was room to write a history of a group of people with kind of one eye on what's happening militarily on the Western Front, but then the other eye on what I would call kind of the felt history of a group of people who were responding in real time to horrific events around them and aren't necessarily conscious of the overall military situation that's going on around them. So it was that idea of kind of the intimacy of the front for a group of people that don't necessarily know the big picture, but then what's going on with the big picture around it. And so the book, in many ways, becomes a balancing act between that. Now, to go back to your question about being an American, I think that American readers are intrigued with World War I because they buy into, what's a good way to phrase this? What's the Western Front Association? So I think I can say this. So I'll say they buy into the mud, blood, pathos, kind of futility school of the First World War. And I think a lot of Americans who know anything about the war, that's what they think about. And they think it's, that's a very emotionally kind of appealing concept, like the tragedy of the war. So what I wanted to do is write a book that would appeal to people on both sides of the Atlantic, showing them that the people who fought the war were real people with real emotions, doing a really rough job in real time as events were changing around them. And that story is very complex. And I hope as it's told in the book, it'll give readers a more complicated view of how the war was fought and who fought it. So I want people in my country to appreciate the soldier experience of the BEF. And I hope that people in Britain don't necessarily mind that it's an American telling that story.
I always think it's interesting that they have that perception of, I suppose, the Blackadder view of the Great War, when often they don't know that their own country participated and fought with the American Expeditionary Force. And again, that's I think probably the greatest American commitment of forces to the Western Front. I could be incorrect in that, but it's certainly a significant one, on a par with their involvement in the Second World War. And often that's not known. People don't know about Americans and their amazing achievements on the Western Front, fighting in the Mersey, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting, they have that perception of British forces. And again, that view is still held, unfortunately, by many people in
Right.
Britain and across Europe. So let's move on to the book. Now, your book delves into the emotional history of the soldiers. How did you approach capturing their personal experiences and emotional resilience of the men in your narrative?
So as you know, Tom, this is a really tough part about research. And it's a tough task when you're looking at a group of people that are all different and are, of course, having different responses to the same task in which they're being asked to do. I would say that it requires a broad base of sources and a bit of reading between the lines of those sources to see what might be there or what not might not be there, or what might not be being told by those experiences. I think that's a little bit dangerous for historians to read too much into your sources, but I think you need to do a little bit of it. So to give an example, Piers was a very emotionally reticent officer. He's not uncommon in being like that, but he doesn't write deeply about his emotional experiences home. So one of the things that we need to do, and one of the things that kind of I was challenged to do, is to kind of look around and see what's going on around him and to see that there's actually a story in the emotional reticence, right? So to give an example, when he writes his mother on the morning of the 21st of March, 1918, he writes her a very short letter. It's a short, gossipy letter home, basically saying, "Mom, I'm okay. I received your latest letter. Thanks for sending me some milk punch, et cetera, et cetera. I might have to go up the line later on, but he's not sure." And then he closes the letter, "Just love to all, Jack." It's a short little letter he writes beginning of the morning of 21st March, 1918. When he's writing the letter, he's under the weight of the worst bombardment that he's ever experienced in the First World War. He's writing it in a moment in which he obviously doesn't know whether this is going to be the last letter he's going to write home. And he knows that the attack they've been waiting for has finally come. And so kind of building that broader story out of the letters is a big challenge for us, but just trying to use our imaginations as historians to kind of figure out what those moments looked like, and then the way in which they're being written about, I think is one of the big challenges. And so in the book, I try to do that with not only Pierce's work, but also, the letters of some of his other officers, the experiences, what you can read into the service records of some of these men, to just try to understand the level of kind of intimacy of the human experience of the First World War. I'm not sure if that answers your question exactly, but it gets close to it, I think.
Now, okay, I know what you mean. It's always very difficult when you look at documents which are 100 years old, and they often have a very different value system.
Yeah.
So I've been visited by my furry assistant, has finally emerged. Sorry, listeners, that is the cat who is rather wanting to be involved in this production. So, yes, it's always very difficult to do that because, we've only got words, and we often judge those words by our values,
Yeah.
So ideas of empire and stoicism and manliness, as they would have had it, would be alien to what we would, see these values today. And they were also, good empire-loving misogynist racists by our are construction. And so we have to accept what they are and not want to Xerox our own values. I mean, you probably tell your students this all the time, but it is always difficult. So sorry, I digress. So let's get back to the book. Now, the 8th Battalion, it fights in a number of battles at Loos, the Somme, and Passchendaele. Do these experiences conflict or differ from sort of more familiar narratives of the battle, especially the narratives of those men who served in the unit?
Yeah, so this is one of the aspects of the book that I will say I struggled with a little bit, because I think that, on the one hand, for those of us who have kind of come up in First World War scholarship of like the last 20 years, there's this revisionist impulse, right, that you are approaching the military history of the BEF with, that sure, there is a real learning curve, there is, we should be evaluating generalship and kind of a different standard than would have been done in the 1960s, et cetera, et cetera. But then when you're reading kind of some of the official military documents and you're looking at like the brigade war diaries and the battalion war diaries, like units like the 8th Battalion they're going through an awful lot in their experience, right? And so when you get drilled down to kind of the battalion level experience of the war, we're able to see kind of the learning curve that's happening at a high level, but the battalions that are going through the meat grinder of service are still going through a rather rough patch of it. So that was the balance in which I was trying to have to deal with, is kind of saying, okay, militarily, the BEF is learning things on the Western Front. They're changing the way in which they're fighting, et cetera, et cetera. But for battalions like the 8th Battalion, the task they're asked to do oftentimes is a pretty difficult task. That being said, there is no question that there's a huge difference in the battalion that is fighting in 1915 at Loos and then the battalion that's fighting in 1918 in the Spring Offensive. So the battalion that fights at the Battle of Loos, they've only been in France for a few weeks. They go into battle in open air daylight attack with no artillery support, in which they suffer horrific casualties. And by the end of the war, they're fighting offensives like at 3rd Ypres. Toward the end of the war, they're fighting at 3rd Ypres using creeping barrages, timed barrages around them. They're using Lewis gun teams. They're using small unit assault parties in really creative and interesting ways. And then they're able to fight a really harrowing but really impressive rear guard action during the Spring Offensive of 1918. So there's definitely a learning curve that happens amongst officers and amongst men in terms of their experience fighting. But again, in each one of these battles in which they fight, they suffer pretty high casualties.
And that's a really, I mean, digressing for me, because I think it's a really interesting. So you can demonstrate that they learn, they fight in different ways, and but ha that they suffer casualties. So how, in a way, does a battalion learn? And because I think this is what often is missing from the historiography, is that we all assume that that we get SS 143 and these various documents which change the way the British Army function, creeping barrages, etc. But then again, how is this actually disseminated at battalion level, especially when you've got casualties, people going through the meat grinder? I think that's one of the un, I suppose, proven things. And I wonder whether your book reflects on that sort of process.
So it does to some degree. I mean, I think that the key thing is that and I think your point about casualties is a really good one, because especially when you look at officer casualties, so some of their more experienced, like company commanders, for example, they're in almost every engagement, they're losing at least one company commander, right? And so they're suffering significant kind of casualties at the medium level of kind of the battalion's leadership structure. That being said, their senior leadership after the Battle of Loos remains pretty consistent. So it's their senior leadership that seems to be getting better at their job, or their senior leadership team that keeps getting better at their job as they're going along. And they're going off for training. I mean, and that's the other side of it, is that you realize when you're looking at a battalion war diary and a brigade war diary, that these units are being rotated in and out and going into training and different types of training all of the time. So the stuff that they're being trained with in 1917 is different than how they're being trained in 1915. And it's just that is just a result of the British Army just changing what its doctrine is over the course of the war. So, that's a very tough question, but I think two things for the Eighth Queens. One is senior leadership, and then the other one is that they're just relying on being trained in the right way.
Yeah, because I think it is really interesting about, and I've done a bit of work on this. This sort of how do units learn if you've got casualties? And I think you part in one officers. Firstly, officers survive far more than we think. They don't last 6 weeks. That is a myth. And secondly, I think there's something about culture within battalions that you get certain social norms, certain sort of operating procedures are passed down from officers. So new officers who arrive are acculturated into the particular mores structure of a unit. So it's interesting, each battalion is slightly different, has slightly different traditions, and that I think often inculcates a culture which is passed from officer to officer and transferred from person to person, and it's very difficult to prove, but I think that's the way that learning often is transmitted. I've got some documentary evidence to prove that, but again, it's a difficult one to do, and it's very anecdotal. But
Definitely. And part of it is just that the sources that you're working with are pretty limited in kind of the intimate ways in which that learning transfer is happening between senior officers to junior officers to more junior officers, right?
yeah, I suppose to digress here, did the 8th Battalion participate in raids at all?
Yes, so they do. And actually they one of the raids become kind of one of the means of training them or kind of indoctrinating them to the Western Front. And they're not unique in this, as you know, but so after the disaster that befalls them at Loos, they go into a pretty regular trench rotation up at Ypres. And in the process of that trench rotation, they're kind of gearing up for then training for their first raid in which they conduct. And they do that in 1916. And then after that, they do go on regular kind of raids. And so raiding becomes a part of their culture.
Again, it's fascinating how some units raid and other units don't, even within the same brigade. And that's what I'm always fascinated in, and how some units are very good at it and some units are very poor at it. And so again, I mean, it's trying to explain that. I mean, I think that's a cue for any young PhD student who wants to do something on raiding. I'm sure there is a tremendous amount there, but we digress. Now, let's get back to the book. Now, you're obviously there are hundreds of books on the Western Front and the Great War, and I'm currently writing one which will add to the ongoing landfill of this scholarship. So what sets your book, I suppose, what in what ways is your book different from what's come before?
So this is a dreaded question, right? It's a tough question to answer, I think, for a lot of authors because there's so much good work out there that's been done, and there's a lot of work that I admire that other writers have written in terms of kind of small unit histories. I think it stands out a little bit. I mean, as you've probably noticed, maybe you should tell me. In that, what I'm trying to do with the book is to write a different version of a story that we know. So the story that we know of a regimental history or a unit history is kind of going through the order of battle, kind of going through the exact actions in which they're engaged in, and things like that. Writing a very chronologically based history, which of course I'm kind of doing within this book. But I looked at some other micro histories of small unit histories that I admired that were doing something a little bit different by focusing on kind of the human experience of people who were actually serving in these units. And there were two examples from Civil War historians that I admire. One is Susanna Urell, and the other one is Leslie Gordon, who both wrote kind of new unit histories or social histories of units that focused on issues of such as like relationship with people at home. Right, in the sense of the difference between the home front and the war front, right? We're also focused on tropes such as cowardice or focused on tropes of heroism and things like that, right? So I kind of looked at their work and I thought about writing a book that could do both the military history of a battalion, but then also to look at the emotional learning curve required by soldiers and officers. And I think, in particular, of officers, because that's where a lot of the source material was coming from, in particular, of their commanding officer peers. What I was trying to do is kind of look at that emotional change that happens to people over the course of the First World War, and to write a book that kind of is a blended approach to both the military as well as the personal side of the war. Not sure if I pull it off, but that's what I was attempting to do with the book.
I think that's a very interesting approach because I'm interested, what is the emotional basis for their resilience? What keeps these individuals going? Now, again, it's a very personal question, and often it's very difficult to gauge that when you're dealing with a stiff upper lip British ruling class who don't talk about their emotions. So it's really interesting. What did you deduce really keeps these individuals going?
So I think part of it, I think that one of the books that really impressed me, and that I've taught and that I keep going back to is Alexander Watson's Enduring the Great War, because I think he brings up some really good points in that book about the importance of leadership and comradeship as kind of essential aspects of survival, emotional survival. And Michael Roper's written about this too, kind of emotional survival of people at the front. And I think when I was kind of looking at kind of that literature on emotional survival or coping mechanisms and things like that, and then I started looking at officers like peers and started looking at the culture of kind of the officers and men of the 8th Queen's, you start to see a picture where that sense of emotional resilience is playing out in a lot of different ways. So one is that they're getting an awful lot of rest time at the front. So they're not under bombardment fighting the entire time, as you know, as anybody who's read war diaries know, right? They're rotated in and out of the trenches quite a bit. They have paternalistic officers that are also looking after them. When Piers is writing home, he's writing home asking for footballs. He's writing home fretting about procuring beer for the men. He's writing home trying to write home to his parents about the state of morale within the battalion overall. And it doesn't seem to have slipped as the war's ongoing, right? So it seems like both through rotation and then through activities out of the line. I mean, they're boxing matches, they're football matches, there's cinema behind the lines. There's kind of this entire infrastructure that's set up behind the lines to make sure that these guys have enough downtime to be able to then go back into the line and function. And so, I think that it requires a little bit of imagination on the part of a historian, but not that much to figure out that actually all of this kind of investment behind the lines is actually playing off into the performance of men when they actually get into battle. So I'm not sure if that's been your experience, Tom, but as I was writing the book, I was kind of astounded by the amount of stuff they're doing behind the lines.
Yeah, I think from my experience, when I'm looking at this, I'm interested in a way, I think the officer class is really interesting. What keeps officers functioning, whether it's their sort of in, I think there's a lot to be said for their sort of internal ideas of duty, stoicism, manliness or masculinity, and there is an internal code that they will not let their men down. This sort of idea that of paternalism towards their soldiers, and not all by any means. I mean, some do break down, but it's amazing how they don't break down. They do have they are tough, but also they're trying to look after people, and this keeps them going. This sort of idea of service. But I do think that the wear and tear, I think people do go through a significant emotional trauma, and I think I can prove that people come very close to breaking down often in real, the paper fine division between breaking down and not. And I have got some examples of people do break down, and a lot of the officers are recycled. Your average rank and file has a very different experience. And actually the numbers of quotes shell shock are very, I think, relatively small. Number of self-inflicted wounds that I've come across, again, are very, very small. So it's a very interesting idea. Now, how that functions if you're a leader and you're expected to do this. And as people generally become more tolerant of shell shock and seeing that as an acceptable get out of jail card. And obviously there's much to be said that these people are deeply emotionally traumatized. But what I think is also probably more amazing is the number who aren't, who actually do come through and do cope with the horrors. And I wonder whether to get your thoughts on that. These are often ordinary citizens who in Edwardian society do have some connection with death. Often they lose children, even in the middle classes. The affluence doesn't protect you from scarlet fever for your children, whooping cough, measles, a lot of these so-called zymotic diseases, which do kill a lot of children in childhood before the First World War. Even these often privileged men, in comparison to their soldiers, they don't deal with this horror on a routine basis, but they enter the trenches and somehow they are able to cope. And I think that is quite amazing when they're surrounded with it for probably one third of their active service. And again, what we don't get in the same way, I mean, we all talk about rats the size of footballs and lice, etc., but we don't talk about the smell, the actually what fear is like and what it's like to be wet and cold for weeks on end. And that, nobody would ever put up with that today. But then you just got into that trench and you were wet and cold in clothing, which was appalling. So, and I suppose it's really complex, but did you discover anything in the way that these people could adapt to the horrors of the front?
So definitely, I mean, I think that Piers is a good example of this because he does come from this very privileged background. I mean, he's Charterhouse, he's Oxford, he then ends up working as a solicitor in London with a very fashionable address, right? So he doesn't suffer a ton of hardship unless you consider the public school experience to be one of incredible hardship for him. But then when he gets to the front, he it's interesting because he, in his first engagement, he doesn't write home. He writes a very emotional letter for him back to his parents after the Battle of Loos. And it's the most emotional letter that he writes in all the letters that he writes home, like the most emotionally affected by his experiences. But then what I found in the British National Archives was he wrote to Sir James Edmonds after the First World War. And he wrote him a letter in which he confesses that after his first engagement, he suffered from considerable mental distress after that first experience of Loos. Now, it doesn't come across overwhelmingly that way in his letters, but just the fact he would confess that after the war, I thought was really interesting. And it showed, and then he makes a comment, says, as any man in the brigade felt, indicating that they all felt that same sense of emotional distress in their first experience. But then the flip side of it is that within 2 weeks, he's writing home to his parents and he's proud of the training of the men. He's writing about Belgian wine and cigars that they'd sent him, right? He's rebounded relatively quickly emotionally from that experience. Now, it will affect him, I've no doubt, internally for the rest of his life, just what the experience of these battles was like and the trauma was like for him. But at the end of the day, I mean, emotional resilience was a key part of how he identified his Edwardian masculinity. And that was important for Piers. It was important for a lot of his officers, too. He does write a letter home in 1916, I think, in which he describes another officer who he said had a constitutional inability to just stick it out. And I thought that phrase was really interesting because it shows that, what Piers is putting as kind of one of the central virtues of the citizen soldier is the ability to endure, is the ability to just suffer the hardship and move on. Because I've no doubt that they thought it was a pretty miserable experience most of the time when they were in the trenches. But I also have absolutely no doubt that for officers like Piers and a number of his other officers, that they took great pride in actually making it through. And so that's a big part of the story of the First World War. And I think you're right that that's a part of the story of the First World War that we oftentimes lose, which is the story of the kind of untold emotional story of what it's like to do what, Lord Moran indicates in his book, to be able to restore kind of that well of courage and to just go about the sometimes mundane, sometimes terrifying tasks of being a regimental officer.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's easy that when we that so few people will talk about this, and this doesn't mean that they're all sissies and they're all thinking about their emotions and having encounter groups and what's and maybe in the way we might approach it today. I open myself up to criticism there, but in the ways that people in Edwardian Britain at that time and Edwardian America were different. They had a different structure of personal values, stoicism, manliness, religion was very important. So, I don't know how religious Piers was, but certainly religion is important to a lot of these middle class lads. On the, that's not to say that it was universal, and it's surprising how religion is important, how they that their knowledge of the Bible scripture really helps them get through. And again, it's a very different world. When sorry, the cat is back. Yes, all right. Sorry. She's back. Where was I? And it's just trying to understand that world in its own terms. And I think that's the danger of scholarship, that we see that they are imperialists, that they are misogynists, they are racists by our standards, and we judge them for that rather than judging them for people of their own time. And we don't have to like their values, and I find them pretty offensive at times, but if we study history, we can't Xerox our own values. I mean, I'm telling you, obviously deal with this with your students, but it's so easy to do when we look back, and they express things that really we don't express today.
Yeah, I mean that's all a part of kind of the historian's journey is trying to, construct a worldview of people at the time and how they believe and why they believe certain things that they believe. And I think that that's a useful exercise to be able to. I think it is part and partly an imaginative exercise to have students do that, to read deeply of the sources and then to try to understand where worldviews come from. And one of the things that I think that I realized as I was kind of writing the book and working on this project for so long is that, I think as a historian, we need to avoid kind of being drawn in too deeply into the emotions of our source materials, but it's really tough not to be caught up in them. So when I was going through the officer service records of the Eighth Queen's, like, there are officers that, there are officers that were shell-shocked. There are officers that their bodies broke down in terms of service. These are young men who would have lived healthy, presumably happy lives had they not gone to war. And the war kind of wrecks their bodies or their minds. And that's not a ton of officers, but it's some of them. And it's tough not to be affected by those stories. But as historians, we need to be pretty detached from our sources, or at least have the veil of objectivity there. But it's hard not to get drawn into their lives, and it's hard not to think of your own life and your own experiences kind of measured up to theirs. And there's a lot of stories in the officers and men of the Eighth Queen's that I came to admire in the course of writing it. Not the, imperialist stuff, not a lot of that. But in terms of just the idea of being able to fight for 3 years on the Western Front and to be able to survive it and to take great pride in that service, I mean, I think there's a great story there.
I often, I mean, I think when I look back, and I myself did not go to a public school, and I'm reasonably skeptical of public school education, but the products of some of these schools were indeed quite remarkable human beings. Now, whether they were indoctrinated, that's another debate. But their sort of sense of duty, their sense of public service, their sense of commitment to others, their sense of putting themselves, before the collective, were really things that civic values today we'd really support. Their sense of patriotism, and obviously there are negative sides to their value structure, but they're in many ways there is certainly something to be admired in who these people were. And again, like any age, they have their problems, faults, difficulties, but there are certain things that you think, oh God, these 18-year-olds, would I have been like that at 18? I was just pretty useless at 18, but these kids were leading people my age, over the top, and doing it. And they may have not done it well, but the point is they did it, and they didn't tread on the keyboard like certain furry people. Sorry, readers, listeners, that's another feline intervention.
and she's coming back for more. I'll put the keyboard up there. So it is just, remarkable in that sense. And I think it's to marvel at that age. And, I don't want to look at that in some sort of remote, romantic, soppy way, but I do think we have to see that sometimes these lads were not just upper class twits who just, it wasn't Blackadder writ large, I suppose, is what I would say.
Yeah, and so one of the interesting things about the 8th Queen's, so they're in the 72nd Brigade, 24th Division. They're then transferred to the 17th Brigade, but they're in the 24th Division for the whole of their service, like all battalions, they kind of stay with their division. But they but one of their kind of sister battalions is the 9th East Surreys, which was RC Sheriff's battalion. And so one of the things, when I was writing the book, I certainly was conscious of the fact that they're, one of the great works of literature to come out of the First World War, and one of the great, in many ways, archetypes of what the officer experience was like is through Journey's End. And knowing that, the author of Journey's End is one battalion over from Pierce, right? And that they're having kind of that similar experience, was something that was pretty. It was pretty amazing to think about as I was writing the book that they are in the same engagements. It's the ninth East Surreys that come up to relieve the 8th Queen's at Third Ypres, and RC Sheriff's wounded in that relief party, and Piers is moving back with his men just as that battalion's coming up. And so I certainly was conscious of kind of how. Because I think one of the great things that that play does is it shows how different officers are reacting to kind of the same events. And I think that you see kind of that panorama of experiences in the officers of the 8th Queen's too.
I suppose just for balance, we should just touch on the other ranks. Now, did you get a chance to actually examine some of the other ranks' experience in the 8th Queen's, or was your source material mainly directing you towards the officers? Obviously, their records often survive more than the other ranks do.
Yeah, so I did go through service records of some of the men in the battalion. I also, and I'd help from Jenna Fleming, who was formerly a research assistant on the Piers Project, but is now one of our key kind of staff members on the Digital History Project. Jenna pointed me in the direction of a number of soldiers who wrote into local newspapers of their experiences. And those letters are incredibly insightful because there's soldiers who are writing, in many ways, tributes to fellow soldiers who had fallen in battle. So kind of through newspapers, through some service records, through some letters I found in other accounts, I was kind of able to get some material having to do with other ranks. And in one chapter, the life and death chapter, which is the cent kind of the central part of the book, or the center chapter of the book, I kind of juxtaposed kind of the experiences of some men in the ranks with some of the officers of the battalion and kind of their day-to-day lives. So I was able to get into some of that material, but most of the source material was from official documents, the Piers correspondence. There was a handwritten battalion history in the Surrey History Center that was written by a former officer. It's actually incredibly insightful. I think I know who that officer might be. I'm not entirely sure. You'll have to read the book to find out. But so most of the materials in the book kind of came from those three source piles. I wish I had more material, and I hope that if there are listeners out there with materials about their relations who served in the 8th Battalion, we'd love to feature them on our digital history project.
Yes, so either contact Ian directly at Gettysburg College for that, or contact the WFA and we'll put you in touch. Now, drawing to a close, the other really, I suppose, dreaded question that I will certainly fear is, so what are the lessons and takeaways of your book? What do you want readers to understand about the human experience of the battalion? And what does it reveal about the nature of warfare? And a really difficult and impossible question. But as I'm not being asked it, I'll turn it over to you.
Well, I think they'll have to read the book to find out. But if I was going to just summarize briefly or kind of tease it out, so I would like readers to go in with their preconceived notions of what the experience was like in the First World War, to read the book, and then to see if they find any of those preconceived notions challenged. And I think they might find some of them. So I think in parts of the book, I'm certainly pushing back against some official kind of stories of how some of these battles went on. I think in other parts of the book, I'm just trying to show an empathetic portrait of what it was like to for a unit to be enduring what they were enduring. So overall, I think what I wanted readers to get out of it was through a microcosm, kind of the history of the experience of the Western Front for British soldiers who were citizens first and soldiers second, who a lot of them, most of them made it through the war, but they did so in incredibly harrowing and difficult conditions that in the end, a lot of them felt, of course, complicated things about their service, but a lot of them ended up feeling pride enough in their service to commemorate it afterward. And I think as we're leading into Remembrance Sunday and Armistice Day, I mean, the book concludes with officers and some of the men of the 8th Queen's meeting for different rituals throughout their veteranhood in commemoration of their service. And I think that, you know, understanding a bit more of what that service looked like gives us a greater appreciation of what their acts of remembrance look like now.
And my penultimate question, what projects are you working currently on, and do they connect to the First World War?
So I'm taking a little bit of a departure. I am contracted to write a book on American war memory from the Civil War to the Global War on Terror. So it's a very different book than the one that I just wrote. I taught for a year at the U.S. Army War College, and it kind of inspired me to write a book on the way that Americans look at the politics of war and commemoration in our culture. So I'm writing something that's very different, but it will have a chapter on the First World War.
And finally, where can people get this book from and learn more about your work?
So people can get the book from Pen and Sword, who published it. They can get it from their bookstores, their independent bookstores, or from online bookstores as well. It will be released in the United States relatively quickly. It's already out in the UK, but it's coming out in the US in mid-November. And if people are interested in other aspects of my work, just Google my name and there's a bio on Gettysburg College's website, and you can look at some other publications there.
Ian, thank you very much for your time.
Tom, it's been an absolute privilege. It's been an honor. Thank you so much for having me on.
You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Russman and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS2195. Until next time.